Pasuk Lamentes. We're coming to the close of the discussion of Shlomo HaMelech, a few more psukim to go. We should finish before the summer. So we had mentioned that the Seder Olam, and it's brought down in a number of Medrashim, Yaakov Shimoni, other places, that when the kingdom was taken away from David HaMelech, I don't know exactly how to phrase this, let's call it the original intent, or the primary intent of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was that the Melucha should be removed for 36 years. Keneged the 36 years that Shlomo was married to Bas Parah. And that would have taken place in the rule of Asa, the grandson of Rechavam. However, when Asa was faced with a potential battle, he solicited help from Aram, sent him money from the storehouses of the Beis HaMikdash, and that was a lack of proper bitachon on the part of Asa. And as a result, they were not zocha to regain the kingdom. Afal Pikain, and Rashi brings both of these before Hashem, that still the word of Hashem, Ach lo chol hayamim, will be fulfilled, because in the times of Mashiach, the kingdom will return to David HaMelech. So we pointed out that here we have an example of something that we find in other places as well. I called it multiple options for history. When we have prophecies and nevuos about how history is going to unfold, there isn't necessarily always only one plan or one direction. There are multiple options. And this is one example. It could have lasted for 36 years, and in the end, it lasted for thousands of years until the Melucha goes back to David HaMelech. Another idea we pointed out, which is a famous Chazal B'Yitoa Chishena, that Hashem said, I will hurry Mashiach in his proper time. So if it's coming in its proper time, what do you mean hurrying it? Chazal said, if you're hurrying it, what do you mean proper time? And the explanation is there are two choices. If Klal Yisrael does tshuva, Hashem will hurry it. Mashiach will come in a day. If Klal Yisrael does not do tshuva, Mashiach will still come in its proper designated time. So the idea is that history carries various options. We say in our tefillos every day, excuse me, Vavienu l'shalom, me'arba kamfos aretz, v'saluchenu kamimiyos la'artzenu. Bring us in peace from the four corners of the earth, and lead us upright to our land. That's obviously referring to Kibbutz Galios. Yet we have many prophecies that Kibbutz Galios is going to take place through war and violence and Muhammad's Gog and Magog. So what are we davening for? Hashem already says it's not going to happen. And the Mefarshim on the Tefillah explained the same thing, that there are multiple options for history. There is a nevuah of all these Muhammads, but it doesn't have to be that way. This is only one of the options available. The Velt says, I don't know if there's valid sources for this or not, but we do find throughout the Doros different great Gedolim from time to time make these predictions when Mashiach is coming, and the Mashiach so far hasn't come. These predictions haven't been valid. But the Velt says those were times that Mashiach could have come. I don't know if they're right or not, but they could be right. It is possible, such a concept, that there are different plans for history, and there are certain opportune moments, and given different various factors that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows, maybe plan one, plan two, who knows how many options there are. But history is not a simple thing, and the Vu is not a simple thing. And this sort of reinforces a concept that I talked about before, that there's a great, great danger in conducting one's life or one's policies in order to fulfill what you think are prophecies of Tanakh or Chazal, in order to bring Mashiach or bring the Geula. Because the most basic problem is that you're probably wrong. The whole nature of all these predictions are designed specifically so they should not be understood until after the fact. And this is a pasuk in Daniel. The pasuk says, Advarim stumim v'chasumim ad es keitz. These prophecies of Daniel, and it doesn't refer only to the prophecies of Daniel, are hidden and sealed until the end of days. And the Mefarshim say, if they're hidden and sealed, why were they said? And they answer, until the end of days, v'lo ad v'chlal. But ad is not included. Whenever you say until, the question is, until, does it include that or not? Meaning, in retrospect, we'll see what the prophecies mean. And you'll look back and say, oh, that's what it means. So what's the purpose? The purpose is to provide chizuk, not to provide direction. Once the prophecy is fulfilled, then you look back and say, oh, clearly that's what it meant. I guess a classic example is what we would think is a relatively simple prophecy. That Yirmiyahu HaNavi said that the galus above will last 70 years. And nobody could figure out what the 70 years were. And the famous story that Ahasuerus made the Suda, the Kelim, Mikelim, Shonim, unusual Kelim. He took out the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash because he thought the 70 years were up. So he said, well, Ahasuerus, Melech Tipesh Hoya, of course there's a machlokas about that. We tend to view Ahasuerus as a fool. There's a machlokas in the Gemara, Melech Tipesh, Melech Chacham. But Daniel made the same mistake. And the Pasuk says, Ani Daniel Binosi Al Asfarim, he thought the 70 years were up also. And later we see, no, the 70 years are counted from the time of the Churban, not from the time of the conquest, and then 70 years exactly. So the purpose of Nevuahs are not intended that we should be able to figure them out in advance, but rather that you should be able to see, understand them afterwards and provide the Chizuk and the Muna, oh, things are happening the way Hashem commanded them. So that's really the most basic reason, but now we see a secondary reason. Yes?
What's the point of Chizuk when Moshiach will come? We'll know retroactively when Moshiach will be here.
Because there's going to be interim stages until, you know, as we're going through the steps to Moshiach, we're going to need the Chizuk. So the general idea that there's Moshiach, we know that certain things we know in advance, but the particulars, as they unfold, we get the Chizuk. When it's all over, at that point we probably don't need it anymore. But there's a secondary reason as well, which is even if your interpretation of the Chazal or the Pasuk is correct, but it's only one of several options in all likelihood, or it could be. So you might be barking up the wrong tree. You're trying to bring around plan B, and Kadosh Baruch Hu is working on plan C. So one can never be confident, even im timsal lomar, that you've got it right, which is highly unlikely, you still could get it wrong, because you're working on the wrong option. More fundamentally, it's not our job. I've mentioned this before as well, but it bears repeating. It's not our job. There is no mitzvah in the Torah to bring Mashiach. Contrary, there's a mitzvah to believe in Mashiach. But to bring Mashiach, there is no such mitzvah. Contrary to popular music, starting from children's songs and working its way up, that's not the proper Derech HaTorah. The Derech HaTorah is a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave us Torah and mitzvahs, and he gave us a plan how to live our lives, and this is what he wants us to do. It's a Kadosh Baruch Hu's job to bring Mashiach. And if people attempt to fulfill prophecies, unless they were given a directive, you know, which happens, you know, or at least used to happen in the times of Nevuah, but in essence, our job is to do what's right. And there's a really pretty much a Beferish Gemara that explains this. The famous story of Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu HaNavi. Chizkiyahu saw with Ruach HaKodesh that his son was destined to be, was going to be, you can't say destined, but was going to be a terrible Rasha. Menashe ben Chizkiyahu was one of the worst Rishonim amongst all of Malchei Yehuda. And he decided therefore not to have children. Why should I bring such a Rasha into the world? Chizkiyahu got very sick and was on the verge of death. So Yeshayahu came to see him, and Yeshayahu gave him a prophecy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decreed that he will die from this illness because he was mevatel the mitzvah of Purabu, he wasn't having children. So Yeshayahu said, but my child's going to be a Rasha. So Yeshayahu answered, Bahani Shvili Derekia Lamalam. Why are you walking in the pathways of heaven? It's none of your business how history is going to conduct itself. It's none of your business how your child is going to be. And the Gemara explains, although it's true that Menashe turned out to be a great Rasha, but Menashe's son, Yoshio, turned out to be a great tzaddik. So you can't judge, you can't control history. So he said, if that's the case, so I have a suggestion. said Chizkiyahu, why don't you give me your daughter as a shidduch? And maybe your schus, my schus together could change the gezerah, and Menashe will turn out to be okay. So Yeshayahu said, not a bad idea, except I just finished telling you that you're dead. You're going to die. So there's not going to be a wedding. So this time, Chizkiyahu gave Musa to Yeshayahu and said, you're wrong. He says, Kach mikublani mibeis avi abba. I have a mesorah from my ancestors. Afilu cherev chadam unachas al tzavara shal adam al tisayash min apranias. Even if the sword is resting on your neck, you never give up hope. The gzerah could be averted. And that's what happened. Chizkiyahu did tshuva, and the gzerah was averted, and he did marry the daughter of Yeshayahu, but it didn't help. Menashe still turned out to be a rasha. But that is the story. But what's the Gemara saying? Bahani shvila derikil lamalon. You have no right to act that way. If you have a mitzvah to have children, then you can't manipulate history. You can't determine that I'm not going to do my mitzvah. Rosh Yeshiva pointed out in the Gemara in Megillah about Esther, the same idea, but an interesting insight. And it's interesting that the two Gemaras are on the same Amud. Must have been planned that way on purpose. But one Gemara says, "Mordechai misalech lifnei chazar beis hanoshim ladas es shlom Esther umayeh seba." Mordechai said, I know that Esther is destined to play a role in saving Klal Yisrael from some danger. Because many, many girls hid out from Achashverosh, and most of them were not found. So Esther, who was such a great tzaddikas, certainly had the schus that she should not have been found. It wouldn't have been very much of a miracle for her not to have been found. And yet she was. Kadosh Baruch Hu must have plans for her. That's why she was taken. So he's waiting and looking to see what exactly Hashem's plan is. The same Amud of Gemara says that Mordechai commanded Esther not to say who she was, who her ancestors were. He says, why? Because she was actually a descendant of Shaul HaMelech, which is a certain yichus that makes her roi to be a queen. She comes from a king's family. But if you don't say who you are, maybe they'll think your parents are a bunch of robbers or illegitimate, mamzerim, and they'll throw you out. You're not suitable to be the queen. So she wouldn't tell who her parents were in order to facilitate her being released. Now one second. Mordechai, didn't you just figure out that Esther is destined to play a role in saving Klal Yisrael? So why are you giving her advice how to get thrown out? The answer is because that's what you're mechuyev to do. You're not supposed to become the wife of this guy. You have to do whatever you can to avoid it. And that's our business. Hani shvila derkiel lamalon. We're not there to walk the pathways of heaven. We're there to do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to do. So you have to figure out every eitzah. This is to try to get out. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants Esther to be the queen, so it won't work. Don't worry. HaKadosh Baruch Hu does his job very well. If he needs Esther to be in the king's palace, Esther will be in the king's palace. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Not only that, the fact that Esther did not say who she was contributed to the Geula, because she was able to blindside Haman. If Haman knew who Esther was, you could be sure he would have taken precautions to either get rid of her or to protect himself against her before he went ahead and attacked the Jews. So so our approach always has to be to do what's right up in Torah and not to attempt to figure out what a Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan is for history and fulfill that plan. And sometimes you see that, you hear that, and it's a very wrong approach. People, this has to happen, that has to happen. For all the reasons we mentioned, that's not how you conduct your life. Fundamentally, it's philosophically wrong. We're supposed to do what's right, not to control history. And number two, your interpretation could very well be wrong. And number three, even if it's right, it could be wrong, because maybe Hashem is working on a different option. History has multiple options. The Kli Yakar adds an interesting nuance to this pasuk. If you look again inside the pasuk Lamates, which we're discussing, "Va'ane zera David, I will afflict the zera of David leman zos, because of this, ach lo kol hayamin." Zos, he says, is an allusion also to zos, to this one, it's lashon nekeva, female, this lady, Laman Zos, because of this lady. Who is this lady? Bas Paro. So this is an allusion to the pshat of the Seder Olam and the Medrash, that the whole reason for this gezeirah was primarily because of Bas Paro, and it could have been just for 36 years had they conducted themselves properly. Now there is another alternative explanation of this pasuk. The Radak sort of suggests it and rejects it, and the Malbim suggests it and defends it, at least in one of his perushim. We've been learning Va'ana Zera David refers to the fact that the Zera David will not rule over all of Kali Yisrael. Hashem will punish or afflict Zera David, that their kingdom will be limited. But really, you could have learned it, and a more simple reading of the pasuk would have been, I will give them tzaras. Va'ana Zera David Laman Zos. I'll give them lots of tzaras, lots of difficulties, lots of hardships. They'll have military difficulties, political difficulties, economic difficulties. I will afflict them. So the Radak says that can't be pshat because it isn't true. Many of the Malchei Beis David were tzaddikim and had very successful reigns and were not afflicted. So therefore, Va'ana Zera David refers to the fact that they will only rule over part of Kali Yisrael, and that in fact did take place even for the kings that were tzaddikim. But the Malbim suggests that it's not shver to learn that way. You can learn Va'ana Zera David means I will afflict them with all kinds of tzaras. Ach lo kol hayamim, but there will be exceptions. Not always. It depends on the king. When the king is righteous, they can overcome this curse, so to speak. And when not, then they will have difficulties. Okay, let's move on to Pasuk Mem. Vayevakesh Shlomo lahamis es Yeravam. Shlomo was seeking to kill Yeravam. Vayakam Yeravam, so Yeravam got up. Vayivrach Mitzrayim, and he escaped to Egypt. El Shishak Melech Mitzrayim, to Shishak, the king of Egypt. Vayivim Mitzrayim had most Shlomo, and he remained in Egypt until Shlomo died. All right, the simple pshat in the pasuk is that this, why does Shlomo want to kill Yeravam? If you recall a number of psukim ago, several months ago, we read how Yeravam was Harim Yad Vamelech. He raised up his hand against the king, and he insulted, he embarrassed Shlomo in public, he insulted him, whatever the various different interpretations. He took off his tefillin, he rebuked him in public, but he acted in a rebellious manner towards Shlomo. And that's why Shlomo wanted to kill him. He was a Marib Malchus. But the problem is, that happened some, whatever it was, 10, 15 psukim ago. In the meantime, we have this whole speech with Achia Shiloni and the whole Nebuah. So why do we interrupt the story? So the Mepharshim explained, and we mentioned this, most of the Mepharshim learned that way as well before, that this is sort of like a digression to explain Yeravam. Yeravam was Harim Yad Melech. How did that come about? After all, as it's going to point out, Yeravam was a talented individual. He was appointed to positions of leadership. He was a big Talmud Chacham. The reason it came about was because he succumbed to the desire for kavod or gaiva. And once Achia Shiloni gave him this nevuah that he was going to be king and all the other factors, that's why it was Harim Yad. So this whole interruption was an explanation of the psychology of Yeravam. Now we're getting back to the storyline that Yeravam was Harim Yad. That would be the simple pshat. Most of the Mepharshim learned that way. The Abarbanel adds another step. The Abarbanel really agrees with this too. Now that is the reason. But he says that it could be that Shlomo heard of the Nevuah of Achia Shiloni, that Yeravam is going to be the king that takes away the Malchus from his son. So that, I think, needs some explanation. Because Shlomo himself, back in Pasuk Yud Aleph Yud Beis Yud Gimel, was given the nevuah that the kingdom is going to be taken away from his son. He's only going to be left with one shevet, two shvatim. So he knew this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted. And certainly according to the prevailing opinion which we are following, that Shlomo in the end was a tzaddik, we invoke Shlomo's chus in our Mishaberachs. So doesn't he accept the Nevuah of Hashem? Even Rechavam accepted that Nevuah. The Pesukim are going to relate later, when the kingdom was split, Rechavam gathered together a huge army and was going to attack Yeravam and his followers and regain the Malchus. And a Navi came and told him that Hashem was gozer this Gezerah, and Rechavim called it off, called back the troops. So wouldn't Shlomo do the same thing? So why would Shlomo be pursuing Yerubbaam because of the Nevuah of Achia Shiloni? Other Rabbah, accept the Nevuah, it's a prophecy from Hashem. What do you think you're going to do? You're going to fight against the Kadosh Baruch Hu? Right, so it won't be in his days. He didn't take the Malucha. He wasn't successful. He didn't take the Malucha. So I think you have to say that the Pshat is the only reason why Shlomo was chasing Yerubbaam was because he was a Marad B'Malchus. He's following the Halacha. Marad B'Malchus is Chayim Misa. And not to prevent him from taking the Malucha. And other Rabbi Shlomo figured, if I kill Yerubbaam, somebody else will take the Malucha. I'm not saving Rechavim at all. He knew the Nevuah of Hashem will come true. However, Yerubbaam deserves to be killed. So what does the Abar Avinel mean that he heard the Nevuah and that had an impact? I believe it means that it had a subconscious impact. There is a very fundamental concept in human nature that certain subconscious biases, the Bali Musa call it a negia. Negia literally means a plague. You're infected by a subconscious bias that affects your conscious judgment. If you ask Shlomo why he's out to get Yerubbaam, the answer is because he's a Marav Malchus. And you say there's a Nevuah of Achia Shiloni. He says, okay, but that's if Yerubbaam deserves it. Clearly, Yerubbaam is a Rashi, doesn't deserve it. But the Nevuah will be fulfilled. There's no question, I am not accomplishing anything in terms of preserving the kingdom. But Rechavim, it ain't going to happen. Rechavim is going to lose the Malucha. Hashem told me so. But it's not going to be Yerubbaam because he deserves to be killed. But that judgment that Shlomo made was clouded in a certain sense. Why is he taking the Malucha away from me? He's taking the Malucha away from my son. Had his judgment not been clouded, he may have decided that Yerubbaam did not deserve to be killed. Because Marad B'Malchus is not an absolute. We mentioned this a number of times. There are all kinds of judgments. The king has the right to kill him, but he's not obligated to kill him. And there might have been cheshbonos and reasons not to do it. And had Shlomo not been somewhat nogea because of the fact that he had heard that Yerubbaam is the one who's going to take the Malucha away from him, he may have reached a different judgment. And this is how human nature works. And at the risk of trivializing it, but you know, I was a high school principal for many years, and I found a very good way of explaining this concept to high school students that works for adults as well. It sounds a bit trivial, but it isn't, because it illustrates human nature. I call it the first base syndrome. You have a bunch of yeshiva guys playing a baseball game. They're reasonably honest, friendly fellows. There's no money at stake in the game. They're just having a good baseball game. There's a close play at first base, and there's an argument. We don't have an umpire. So there's an argument. Is the runner safe? Is the runner out? So what happens? The runner thinks he's safe, and the first baseman thinks he's out. By the law of averages, at least 50% of the argument should be the other way. You should have 50% of the time that there's an argument, the first baseman thinks he's out and the runner thinks he's safe, and 50% should be the other way around. The first baseman thinks that he's out, that he's safe, and the runner thinks that he's out. Yet that doesn't happen. Why not? Are they cheaters? They're not cheaters. But they're nogea bedavar. They have a bias. Each person wants to win the game. So the runner wants to be safe, and therefore he really thinks he was safe. He's not lying. That's the way he perceived it. And the first baseman wants him to be out, so he really did perceive that he's out. So what do you need? You need an objective third party, the umpire, to make the call. Doesn't mean he's always right either. But at least he's not biased, hopefully. So that is the concept brought down to earth in a relatively trivial way. But that's the way human nature works in very weighty and significant and dangerous things as well. That's the nature of the human being.
You have to
head
it with Shaul, I guess.
Right. A very classic example, and I think it illustrates the extent of this type of thing, is Yosef and the brothers. The Mefarshim explained, the Sefarno in particular goes in great detail, that when the brothers wanted to kill Yosef, and in the end they sold him, they felt that they were acting properly kedin. Because various different things that Yosef did led them to believe that Yosef, in halachic terminology, was a rodeh, that he was out to get them and actually get them killed. And therefore, they were acting in self-defense. Abba lahargo hashken v'hargacha. Reuven disagreed. The brothers had a bias because they were jealous of Yosef. Reuven was the one brother who was less jealous of Yosef. He says, why? Because when Yosef had his dream, he had the sheaves bowing down to him and the stars bowing down to him. So there were 11 stars included in Reuven. Reuven was worried that he wouldn't be included in the Shvatim because he knew he had his own sin when he switched around the bed of Yaakov Avinu. So he was actually quite happy with Yosef's dream. Everybody else was upset. Right? You're telling us we're bowing down to you, we're jealous, you're the leader. Reuven was actually quite happy. You mean I'm one of the 11, I'm also bowing down. So he was not afflicted with the same negia that the others were, and he was therefore able to see the truth. But take this a little bit further. We find a confrontation that happens later when Yosef is the viceroy to the king and the brothers don't recognize him and he gives them a hard time. And the brothers, following what Chazal tells us one should do when difficulties come upon you, you should search your deeds. And they said, Avol Hashemi Manachnu Al Hanar, we are guilty concerning Yosef. We saw the great anguish he was in when he pleaded with us, and we didn't listen. Then it says, didn't I tell you not to sin with the child? And now his blood is being sought. What's this discussion? The Sefarno explains that the brothers look back over the last 20, 30, whatever amount of time it was, their lives, and they couldn't find anything they did wrong. Except this one thing. What did they do wrong? He said, he was pleading with us. He was begging with us. We were cruel. We were heartless. But we weren't wrong. Even now, when they're being faced with these challenges and they realize they did something wrong, the only thing they could find that they did wrong was the callousness. Really, our psak was correct. We had the right to kill it, but he was pleading, he was begging, we should have done something, we should have found some other way. So what did Reuven say to them? No, I still disagree with you. Halo amarti al techetu vayeled. I told you not to sin with him. V'gam damo hinei nidrash. It's not the cruelty. It's not re'inu esoros nafsho bischanu aleinu. It's the blood itself that is being sought. We were wrong. The psak was wrong. So even now they were still arguing. And the Sefarno says a fascinating thing. The Sefarno says, why did Reuven say al techetu vayeled? Why the child? Yeled, he was 17 years old. You don't usually use the word yeled for a 17-year-old. He said, the yesod of the mistake of the brothers and the dispute between Reuven and the brothers was the following. There were several actions that Yosef took that when you put them together constitute a plan of redifa. You add very often in life you have that. One individual piece of evidence by itself doesn't mean anything. One individual piece of behavior by itself doesn't mean anything. But when you string together a whole bunch of them, it's very meaningful. Well, you know, he did this. All right, big deal. But he also did that. Oh, big deal. Also did that. Oh, big deal. Yeah, but he did all three. That's a pattern. So the brothers said, look, Yosef did A, Yosef did B, Yosef did C. There's a pattern here. We see what's going on. Said Reuven, if he was an adult, that would be a pattern. But the nature of youth is that they're not roes hanola, they don't look ahead. They deal with the here and now. And therefore he said these three or four or five, whatever it was, different events are unrelated. They're not a pattern. He's a yelet. The brother said, what are you talking about? He's a genius. He's brilliant. Vayehav Yaakov es Yosef ki ben zekunim lo, says the Targum Baruch Hakima. He was the smartest of all the brothers. He's a big Talmud Chacham. And you're telling me he couldn't put two and two together? And Reuven said, that's right. He's genius, he's brilliant, he's everything else, but he's still a yellow. And it comes with age. It doesn't matter how smart he is. So anyone amongst you who has a really smart son, don't listen to him. You're still older than him. He can't put together the string of events. This was the machlokas. And they still thought they were right. And they didn't agree they were wrong until they actually saw Yosef as king of Mitzrayim. He said, Ani Yosef. That's when Chazal say, Oy lanu yom ha-tochacha. That's when they first realized that they were wrong. By the way, I recently saw, it was very fascinating, there apparently is physiological basis to the Sefarnu's point. When I learned that Sefarnu many years ago, I thought that's just a question you have to have experience, maturity, whatever it is. I saw an advertisement for a auto insurance company, and the headline read, does your teenage son drive like a piece of his brain is missing? And then in smaller letters it says, well, it is. And they said that they've demonstrated a certain part of the brain that controls judgment, basically ro'as hanolad, that the consequences of your actions is not fully mature at the age of 16 or 17, and it doesn't become mature until 20, 21 at that age. So there he says they're physiologically less capable of calculating the consequences of their actions, the ro'as hanolad. So apparently it's actually physiological in nature. But this is what the Sefarnu said. I could have told them, they didn't have to spend all this money on the studies. I could have told them that, just look at the Sefarnu. But they wouldn't have known why. They just would have known that that's the way it is. Now they could tell you which part of the brain is affected. So I guess that's worth something. But the fact of the matter is that this is what Reuben was telling their brothers. He's a yelled. He was emphasizing his youth. And therefore, he's not a rodeh. But this... But the point of the Sefarnu is that the brothers themselves would have realized that too if they weren't biased. If they didn't have that negiah that affected them. They weren't aware that it affected them. They thought they were being objective. They had a strong argument. And they did have a strong argument. They were missing that one point. He's young. Yeah, he's young, but he's a genius. He's so smart. He's smarter than the average 17-year-old. Smart, yes. But ro'as hanolad, no. And therefore, Reuben said, I'll take it to Vayelet. They didn't listen to him. But it is an example, of course, that has tragic consequences. But these are dvarim sha'om din beruma sha'olam. These are not baseball games. But the fact of the matter is, it's the same dynamic of human nature. And it affects us. So what do we do about it? It presents a very, very difficult problem. And this is the famous mashal of the Messias Yisharim. Messias Yisharim quotes the Chazal that says that Olam Hazeh is Dome Techoshech. It's like you're living in darkness. So he says, what happens when you go out in the dark? He said, there are two kinds of mistakes you can make. You could fail to see an obstacle and trip over it or bump into it. But there's something else that could happen. You could see something and misidentify it. You could think an amud, a pillar, is a person, or a person is a pillar. So there's two kinds of mistakes. A person could just fail to see, doesn't pay attention. Olam Hazeh gets you caught up in its ways. You don't even realize that there's a problem here. But there's a second mistake. You do think about something. You do realize something. And you've decided that this is a mitzvah, and it's really an avera. Or you've decided that this is an avera, and it's really a mitzvah. Because you've made up arguments and rationalizations based on your negias, like the brothers did. The brothers thought they were fulfilling a mitzvah in killing Yosef or selling Yosef. And it was really an avera. Shlomo thought he was doing a mitzvah in chasing Yeravam. And it could be, it isn't clear from the psukim who was an avera or not. We don't know.
Excuse me, Rosh Hashiva. Since Reuben wasn't involved in the selling the Yosef to the Egypt, so how come still he was punished by Hashem?
By what?
How come still he's punished?
Because he's part of Kal Yisrael. That's the way it works. Kal Yisrael are Ravim Zebazah.
Oh, thank you.
We work together. But the fact of the matter is that a person can make a mistake and think right is wrong and wrong is right. So what's he supposed to do about that? If I think it's a mitzvah, how am I supposed to know that it's an avera? So it's a difficult problem, and there are a number of eitzes, and none of them are quite foolproof, but a person has to struggle against this. One eitzah, which when practical is very effective, is as the Rabbeinu Yonah explains in Pirkei Avos, he says, I say lecha rav, knei lecha chaver. He says, the purpose of that, he says, is to find somebody you could talk to who won't necessarily share your biases, or at least not to the same extent. And they may be able to set you straight. So if you're shol eitzah, you talk to other people who are not so directly involved, and don't share the same biases, they might be able to see through your arguments. It's not foolproof because you're going to present the case the way you see it. And therefore, sometimes that itself affects the judgment. But it's helpful. Also, it's not always practical. Sometimes you have to make decisions and have the opportunity to ask. But it is a very effective eitzah, and very helpful is to be shol eitzah, to discuss with other people. Often you see people who are reluctant to do that. I know this is the right thing to do. So why don't you check it out? Why don't you ask, oh, I don't want to waste his time. I don't want to waste the rabbi's time. You're willing to waste the rabbi's time for every kind of Irish guy, but not for this. He says, why? Because in your heart, you realize that you might be wrong, but you don't want to be told. You don't want to hear somebody tell you something different. So that's very, when you have that resistance, you know you're being affected by negiyos.
But Rosh Hashiva, who would the Shvatim have to be shol eitzah with?
Okay, it didn't work for them. They had Ruvain, but they didn't listen to him.
Even Hashem was in the basement, right?
Well, I don't know if he told them anything, though, but that's actually, it's not always foolproof. You don't always have the opportunity. They heard Ruvain's argument, but it didn't convince them.
What caused them not to go to Yaakov?
They couldn't go to Yaakov. They're saying the whole thing of Yosef was he's fooling Yaakov. How could they go to Yaakov?
Well, you might have more than a brother, you stood better. Why do you have more people of brain? Why did someone all the time Ruben? Why do you understand?
Because he didn't have the same bias. Yeah, he wasn't as biased because he wasn't so upset by the dreams as the brothers were.
I don't think he was biased. He was brought out. You know, he heard something, he heard that he was part of the...
You mean he was biased in the other direction? That's the uncharitable way of looking at it. But he happens to have been right, so we all have to say that, but you're right. But he didn't have the same jealousy. A second, I see we're going to have to continue this next week, but we'll get a little further. A second tool in the arsenal, so to speak, against this very, very difficult challenge of self-deception and rationalization is something the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal always used to refer to as pushing buttons. A person has the ability, if he wants to question his own motives. You sit down with yourself and you say, self, of course I'm right. Of course I'm a tzaddik. Of course I'm completely l'shem shemayim. But in the unimaginable circumstance that I was wrong, what would be a possible reason why I would be wrong? What possible ulterior motive could I have to do this action? Could it be that I'm jealous? Could it be that I want kavod? Could it be that I want money? What is it that could theoretically be driving me if we were to assume that what I'm doing is wrong? The nature of a human being is that although he can deceive himself, it doesn't penetrate to the fullest depths of his being. He could deceive himself in a conscious way. Just as I mentioned before, the person is reluctant to go speak to the rabbi or to his friend. Why? If he was really and truly convinced that he was right, what would he be reluctant? It's obvious that the rabbi is going to agree with me. It's because at some level he does understand that he's wrong. At that level you could also pick out your negiyas, your biases. So the Rosh Hashanah compared is like you push the button and when you hit the right button it lights up. So if a person is sincere, you have to be honest, you have to be demanding of yourself. Do I really want this? L'shem Shemayim, what would be the reasons? When you hit the right reason, maybe it's wait a minute, that sounds right. You feel it. A sort of dramatic example of this is the I see a few Mordechai and Esther's here. In the conversation between Mordechai and Esther and Megillah, the way the Maral explains Rashi, when Mordechai came to Esther to go to the king, Esther said she doesn't want to go. It's a little bit hard to understand because Esther was a great tzaddikah. She was a nevi'ah. Why wouldn't she want to risk her life to save Klal Yisrael? So the Maral explains that Esther had an extremely logical argument. Esther's argument was as follows. It is now Nisan. The Gezerah of Haman is in Ador. It's 11 months away. If I go to the king without being invited and the king does not stick out his Sharvit HaZahav, I am dead. Now what are you going to do? You have nobody to speak for you in the palace. But the king hasn't called me for 30 days. He's bound to call me soon, within the next few days. I'm overdue. So why don't I wait until the king calls me and then I'll plead with the king? Why should I unnecessarily risk my life and Klal Yisrael will lose out the opportunity? What's the rush? It's 11 months away. If I see that time is going on and nothing's happening, so then I'll go to the king then. I'm happy to go and give up my life. So it's a wonderful argument. Said the Maral, so what was wrong with that argument? Maral said it's a Kabbalistic inyan. Of course, it's the Maral. There's nothing wrong with the argument logically. But al pi Kabbalah, we know that when it's not really what you do on this earth that counts the most, it's what's going up in Shemayim. And when a Gezerah is Nigzar in Shemayim, the longer it sits, the harder it is to uproot it. So therefore, it's necessary to risk your life right now. Klal Yisrael will fast, will daven, and you go and do your hishtadlus, so that we could be okay the gezerah. But if it sits for a week or two or a month, it's going to be much more difficult to be okay the gezerah. So that was Mordechai's argument. So the Rosh Yeshiva asks, so what did Mordechai say? Look in the pasuk. Al tadami b'nafsheich limaleit beis hamelech mikol ha'yehudim. Don't think in your heart, because you're in the palace, you'll escape the fate of all the Jews. Kim ha'charesh tacharishi leis hazos. If you are quiet at this moment, there will be salvation from some other quarters. And you and your father's house will be lost. We're having an argument, Kabbalah inyanim, strategy, this, and you're telling me, Al-Tadami bin Avshech? And the explanation is that Mordechai knew who Esther was. And Mordechai knew that Esther was capable of reaching the same conclusion that he reached. Esther was also aware of the Kabbalah in Yonah. And she should have reached the same conclusion that he reached. So there was a subconscious bias, there was a negia. Esther felt some security because she was in the king's house. So he pushed the button. If he would have argued Kabbalah, so Esther would have counter-argued, who knows where, if he would have gotten anywhere, he wouldn't have gotten anywhere, what would have happened? But he pushed the button. He said, I tell you what's making you tick. You think at some level of subconsciousness that you think that you're safe and you're secure and therefore you're not at risk. You don't feel the same urgency that the rest of us feel. And Esther realized, the light went on. You know, you're right. I do have such a thing. Immediately Esther turned and she said, you're right. Now I understand the argument. So this is the concept we call pushing buttons. A person can identify the negia, and if you're sincere, you're looking for the truth, it kind of lights up. You kind of realize, wait a minute, it is true. And then you could cut through something. Again, it doesn't always work. You have to be sincere. You have to remember to push the buttons. You have to be sincere. None of these eitzes are foolproof. You have to try them all, but they're helpful. We have a few more eitzes, but they're going to have to wait till next week.